morning, Your Honors. I've asked to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. This court's decision in Navy chaplaincy requires reversal of the decision below in which the court improperly assumed that there would be no standing because there couldn't be relief on the merits. I think it's very telling that the VA doesn't even attempt to defend that decision. Instead, the VA is arguing that it should be affirmed for a variety of other reasons, principally Section 511, which is the jurisdiction stripping provision. Section 511 does not apply to this case by virtue of the court's decision in Brody. The second argument advanced by the VA for an alternate affirmance is that there should be no standing. Now, the standing in this case, I think, is quite clear as alleged.
Incidentally, with respect to standing, is it clear on the record below? I suspect it is, but it's not crystal clear in the briefs, that you have affidavits of veterans whose claims are still pending?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. They have alleged concrete and particularized harm.
I understand, but I just want to make sure you had affidavits of veterans.
Yes, sir, we
part of your organization who have claims still pending. I know you have claims of those whose decisions came out too late. They're not really relevant. Under the Lyons case. But the ones who don't have, who have not yet had a decision, would seem to present standing.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's correct. Mr. Bobby O'Daniel has executed an affidavit, and he has sought reopening of his. He went through the system once, and he's now stuck there again. So, with respect to standing, I would respect.
You mean he hasn't had a decision yet?
He has not had a decision yet. So on that issue, I think we are fairly comfortable in having been able to demonstrate concrete and particularized harm. The challenge, I think, as the court below noted, and as the court in Veterans for Common Sense noted, is the relief. How do you fix this? With respect, Your Honor, that is a question that we believe should be decided not on a motion to dismiss. There is no record. At least in the Veterans for Common Sense, a trial was held. We believe that there are any number of ways a court could fashion relief without becoming entangled in the day-to-day operations of the VA. So that
about the APA concern? Isn't it a fact that the individuals who have standing have an adequate remedy through the Court of Veterans' Appeals?
But two issues on that, Your Honor. First of all, I think Brody says not all individual claims even necessarily have to go through the VA system. Constitutional claims, and these are constitutional claims, Brody, I think, recognizes that the court would have jurisdiction. The 511 does not necessarily
strip
that.
Well, we're not talking about 511 now. I'm talking about APA.
An adequate remedy law for the individuals, might in theory be going up to the VA system. The problem, Your Honor, is this.
No, it's more than in theory. The statute specifically gives the authority to the Court of Veterans Appeals to deal with an unlawful delay.
Well, Your Honor, what it does, if I may, the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims has recognized that we can't deal with systemic violations. So I recognize Your Honor's asking about individual violations.
Yes, let me just focus on individual. Right. There's no question that the individual who has standing in your case has an adequate remedy.
I would respectfully submit no, Your Honor, because an adequate remedy at law means on a delay issue, they have to lose, particularly on the appeals.
No. They can file an action for unreasonable delay. They don't have to have a decision.
Well,
under the statute.
Under the statute, but to parse this out, if I may, Your Honor, unreasonable delay. There's two elements of our claim here. One is the initial adjudication process, right, and the likelihood that we'll ever get the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims to issue a writ on that issue is not an adequate remedy at law at all.
Why?
Because they'll never
Why?
Get there. If they'll never get there.
Specifically gives them authority to give you the relief you want here. At least for the individual, why is that not an adequate remedy?
Because the individual will never get to that stage, Your Honor.
What stage? All he has to do is bring an action for unreasonable delay.
Well, but there's no original jurisdiction, I don't believe, in the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. It has to be appealed up the process. They have to lose every step of the way.
That's not clear to me at all. The statute specifically gives you a right to an action before the Court of Veterans Appeals for unreasonable delay.
And the Court of Veterans Appeals has said, we do not have authority to issue writs for systemic delays.
Are you saying he needs a decision to appeal? And the nature of your claim is that there's no decision being issued?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. The Sixth Circuit didn't say that, did it?
The Sixth Circuit did not say that. And with respect to the Sixth Circuit, they got it wrong. And I think this court recognized in the Brody case that they got it wrong. Because the Sixth Circuit viewed 511 as saying...
Well, now, put aside 511. The Sixth Circuit did say, I thought you had an adequate remedy before the CAVC.
CAVC, correct,
yeah.
Your Honor.
They did say that.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would respectfully submit that to the two pieces of this, one is the initial adjudication, the other is the delay. Where's the adequate remedy for the delay in the appeal? Where's the adequate remedy in the appeal? And you have to lose it every step of the way before you can
claim.
Well,
there'll be some individuals who do lose, though, and
right.
Who can then bring an action in the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims on the delay that's occurring in the handling of their appeal.
And with respect, Your Honor, I would submit to this court that having to wait 4.5 years on average before you assert the claim is not
adequate. The point is, while it's waiting, they could complain about the delay being part of the problem.
Well, and, you know, forgive me for parsing here, Your Honor, but that means they have to, in essence, file a series of, I guess, writs to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims at every step of the way. They'd have to say, okay, now I've been waiting here for 6 months, a year for my initial adjudication. If they lose, and they must lose, then they say, now I've been waiting for a year for just a statement of the case, and then they have to wait another year for a record of decision. Then they have to wait another year or so.
Right. At each stage, to the extent there's excessive delay in your judgment or the judgment of the claimant, you would add that complaint to your submission.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that could be addressed, right?
Ultimately,
and if you got one case holding that it was an unlawful delay for the following reasons, that would be a precedent.
It would be a precedent, Your Honor, but that I would respectfully submit that having to wait for 4.5 or more years is not an adequate remedy at law, just to be able to bring your claim on the last piece of the delay. And I don't believe that Brody says that they have to do that. This court has, for constitutional violation, remember, Your Honor, we are alleging not just the APA violation, but the constitutional violation, and the constitutional violation does not suffer that same issue. And I would submit, obviously, the court is skeptical about whether or not that's an adequate remedy law. We submit it is not for purposes of the APA, but for the constitutional violation, at some point, the court gets to say, this is too long. There's got to be some outer bound, and the problem with
what do you think the outer bound is?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not, Your Honor. It is not having to wait 6 months to a year. I think the court could say this is too long. Mm-hmm. I think the court could issue a declaratory relief to say if it's 6 months to a year for an initial adjudication, that is too long. If it can issue a declaratory
let me just focus on that. If we issue a you're now focusing on a declaration and not an injunction, right?
That's part of the relief requested, yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, let's take them one at a time. If we were to issue a declaration saying this is too long, what reason is there to believe that would redress your remedy, redress your problem?
That is an important first step in redressing the problem, Your Honor, because part of what we have seen is that the VA, and I think it's very telling, that the pilot project says they can get this stuff done in a matter of weeks.
Well, it says as to some group that they're making a pilot project.
Fully developed claim, right. But I think the key here, Your Honors, is that they can do it. Now, one could say on the continuum of claims, there might be some claim very complex additional evidence, that it goes beyond. But the point is, there could be, with a declaratory relief order, that is the beginning of the wake-up call to the VA that says the court gets, it's the court, if I may, with respect, Your Honor, the court, rather than Congress, gets to decide what's too long. And that, if I could...
Well, not if the Congress has said this is the way it's supposed to work.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because this is not the Heckler case. That's a very important point. Heckler, what we have in Heckler were two critical things we don't have here. One is, we had a congressional record that said, we, Congress, are weighing, do you get expediency or do you get quality? We vote in favor of quality, fully developed. Same thing, stipulated facts, summary judgment, the court below, you had a record. You have neither of those things here. Congress has never said, the VA has not pointed to a single piece of congressional testimony that says, we know there's a trade-off. We decline to strike the balance any further on the side of expediency. They've never said that.
They added 3,100 positions, and they set up this test program, right? So they think they're dealing with, they're aware of the situation, and they're trying to deal with it, right?
Yes, sir.
And they have gone that far and no further. And you're asking us for a declaration that the agency has nonetheless failed to abide by the law when the Congress has just revisited this issue and said, we're going to give you more employees and a test program.
Correct, Your Honor, but the fact that Congress has said you need to do more is very different than the Heckler case, which says we don't want you to do any more by way
look,
of expediency.
That was an easier case. There's no question about it. It was crystal clear there, at least so it seemed. But here, if we read the statute as the Congress is apparently reading it, it would seem that the agency is working with the Congress and trying to doing what it can or what the Congress accepts that it can do.
That is certainly going to be the VA's argument, Your Honor, but permit me this.
But wait a minute. The question is why a declaration? That was my question anyway. Why a declaration would redress your grievance?
It would be a first important step in redressing the grievance.
But if that means it wouldn't by itself address the grievance, then it would just be an advisory opinion.
No, Your Honor, I would, with respect, disagree in the sense that I believe that it is an important step in saying to the VA, there is an outer limit, and Congress doesn't get to decide what it is. And remember, this record below, there's no
record. Don't you want us to say they've exceeded that outer limit?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that.
We just say there's an outer limit, or they've exceeded it?
There is an outer limit, and what we have before us. And of course, this court has no record on the balancing. All they have is a motion to dismiss. But hypothetically, if we had the record that seems to be developing up here, this court could say, on the record before us, if this court were to make that decision, you could say, this is over the limit. This is over the limit.
Okay, so this is over the limit. Now, what reason is there to believe that that will redress your grievance?
Because we believe, just as when the Congress said to the VA, get serious, do something, do a pilot program. They got it done.
So in other words, what you're saying is if we should say there is a limit, this is too far, we don't have to articulate what the limit is, but this is too far, it would give you the kind of political clout whereby you could argue further either in the Congress or before the veterans courts.
Well, it would be an important...
Or the Veterans Administration. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that's a very important point, yes. If this court has said...
But isn't it a fact that that just falls right within Judge Ginsburg's question? That's the impact that you're describing in an advisory opinion.
Well, no, Your Honor, because if indeed this court should say, or the court below should say, based on this record, this is too far, then it is up to the VA to take some, we believe, as a responsible federal agency... to respond to a decision by...
Suppose it took us 3 years to decide this case. Would we violate the Constitution?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
Because there is no counterbalancing issue here in the sense that this court operates with its own, set of principles and guidelines. There have been courts that have taken years to decide a case. We're talking here about hundreds of thousands of cases that are lengthy.
But it's all based on the proposition that there's an unconstitutional violation for one person or two people, whatever it is. It has to be that. So why would it be, under your theory, an unconstitutional? I mean, this goes to the merits, which we may not ever reach, but I'm curious. Why, if we decide, took us 3 years of arguing to decide this case, wouldn't we have violated the Constitution under your theory?
Well, Your Honor, I have no basis on which to say whether or not the reason for the delay can or cannot be justified. The problem is we know enough about, there's a lot of facts developed below to say there's no basis. There is no basis. There is an outer bound upon which you don't have you cannot justify the delay.
So what's the average length of time it's taking now?
Well, Your Honor, as I understand,
give me a number.
It's right now. I understand recent testimony on the February 4th, and I'm sure counsel will stand to correct me if I'm wrong. General Shinseki said it's now 160 days, but it's going to go, I think he said, to 190 days.
Okay, so let's take it at 160, and that's too long in your view, isn't it?
Yes, sir. It is.
Okay, so we say that's too long. Do we say it's got to be 90?
Your Honor, what I would recommend is that the district court be given an opportunity to develop a record and make that judgment.
So ultimately, the district court would say it's got to be X.
It could. Your Honor, he could.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is a declaration, not an injunction, right?
Yes, sir.
And what reason do we have, or would you suggest would appear in such a record to justify a belief that it would go to 90 if the district court said it has to go to 90? After all, I mean, if they don't have the resources, it's not going to happen.
Well, Your Honor, that's a fact which it's very much disputed. They turned back over $1 billion from a fiscal year of 07 to fiscal year 08. They've admitted they've got all the resources necessary to meet their mission. We do not at all concede, as was the case in Heckler, that it's a zero-sum game. It is not, by any stretch, an undisputed fact that it's a zero-sum game. I see that I'm already well over my time, Your Honor. If I'm about to get the hook, I'd like to be able to have a little bit of time.
Yes, we'll give you a couple minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Charles Scarborough, Department of Justice for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The VA is firmly committed to ensuring that our nation's veterans receive fair and timely decisions on claims for monetary benefits. The VA works closely with Congress to obtain the necessary resources to achieve these goals.
And is it achieving them?
Well, they're working on it, Your Honor. I think it's fair
to
say
that. The answer then is no, they're working on them. Is that what you mean?
The answer is things are improving.
But things are improving.
I think everyone would like the claims processing times to be lower. I mean, the VA's testimony consistently is that they think they can get it down to 125 days on average, and that's the very best they could possibly do. They're inching towards that. The most recent testimony that they provided Congress just last week, I think, was 160 days on average.
And did General Shinseki say, as suggested, that before it can go down, it's going to go up again?
Well, again, there's a problem with training. When you put in new people.
So I guess he did. That's the reason, but he did say that, right?
I'm not sure whether General Shinseki was on the Hill testifying on this particular thing, and I'm not sure whether he said that specifically. I'm not trying to be evasive. But the point is the average days to complete is going down as the resources are being implemented and people are being trained and learning how to do their jobs better. The problem with the claim.
Counsel, you made an array of arguments here, jurisdictional arguments. Which do you think is your strongest?
I would hesitate to choose among them.
Well, I want you to choose.
Okay. I think it's the combination of the general limitations on judicial review of sort of claims seeking wholesale improvement in agency programs. Unreasonable delay, as the Supreme Court made clear in Southern Utah, you have to have a discrete and required agency action. We don't have that here. We don't have that type of situation here. And you don't go from a general mandate to process claims expeditiously to say that, you know, 160 days on average is not expeditious. In fact, most unreasonable delay claims, you're looking at a very specific set of facts rather than sort of on aggregate in a system. I know of no case, certainly after Southern Utah, in which courts have sort of said average processing claims times are unreasonable. I mean, the Mashpee case in this court makes clear that unreasonable.
Is that a jurisdictional question?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly Southern Utah and the unreasonable delay cases under 706 are predicated on a separation of powers sort of concern, that the courts shouldn't be the ones coming in and imposing deadlines where Congress has not. That's certainly also the concern animating Heckler.
What are you saying? It's a political question or something? What's the jurisdictional peg you're arguing on?
I think in some respects it's a separation of powers limitation. I mean, it's a limitation.
Is that a jurisdictional issue?
Well, it's a limitation on the ability of a court to provide relief under Section 706.1, I think, at bottom.
What about his argument that, after all, there's a due process claim here as well as an APA claim?
Well, I think almost any APA unreasonable delay claim can be sort of reconfigured as a due process claim. I don't think there's a different sort of analysis that goes in to, if at bottom what you're asserting is unreasonable delay in the processing of benefits, whether that comes in the rubric of a due process claim or an APA unreasonable delay claim, you still have to find a hook to make that claim.
But not all hooks are jurisdictional. Not all missing hooks are jurisdictional.
I understand, I'm not trying to get hung up on the idea that this is jurisdictional. I mean, that's a
term. We have to decide whether it is in order to know whether we go beyond that. We have to decide whether we have jurisdiction. You've challenged our jurisdiction. And even if you hadn't, we'd have to be confident of it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it's not helpful it would be helpful if you could be clear on where the jurisdictional problem lies.
Well,
do you read Heckler against Day as a jurisdictional case? I see the separation of powers tend to that.
Sure.
But the court uses words like intrusive and inappropriate, and I can't find anything more concrete than that.
I think it comes in the same sense. It is, in some respects, it's a question that is, I think the courts are saying, is committed to the political branches in these sorts of situations.
And those terms didn't appear at all.
Those terms?
Political branches.
Well.
In Heckler against Day.
But again, what Heckler versus Day, and certainly what Southern Utah is, what those cases are about, I think, is that the courts...
You're arguing it's a limitation on judicial power?
Yes, Your Honor.
And therefore jurisdictional for that reason?
Again, I don't think there's magic to the terminology jurisdictional. I'm happy to frame that in jurisdictional terms. I'm aware of lots of Supreme Court precedent that uses jurisdictional a lot of different ways. It's clear something like standing is jurisdictional. It's clear subject matter jurisdiction under Section 511 is jurisdictional. I'm happy to locate it as a jurisdictional argument, but I don't think it's necessary.
Are you familiar with our decision in Thornborough?
I'm sorry?
Are you familiar with our decision in Thornborough?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
1989, which says that the limitations that might preclude a court from issuing the requested relief is not a jurisdictional bar and not thought should not be addressed under the rubric of redressability in standing. Right? We should assume that the relief can be granted for purposes of the standing, and if there's a problem down the road with whether there's a bar to that relief, then we get to it when we get to it.
I understand, Your Honor, and it's not necessary in our view for an affirmance to be based upon standing here. I mean, we cited the Mountain States decision in a footnote in our brief, which talks about limitations on judicial authority going to redressability, and that is something that the court can consider under the rubric of standing in an effort to defend what the district court did. However, there's sort of other, limitations here, including the APA limitations and including the Section 511 and 502 concerns, which clearly are jurisdictional. So,
well, but 511, I don't see how your argument is very powerful there in light of our Brody case. It might have been a powerful argument prior to Brody case, but for whatever reason, we rejected that. Well, excuse me, we articulated reasons we rejected that.
Well, Brody was...
What we rejected in Brody is the fundamental notion which you're relying on, which is that an implicit decision made by the Veterans Organization prior to making an explicit decision is precluded under 511. And we said, no, an implicit decision doesn't count. It has to be an express decision.
Well, I'm not sure that Brody it should be read that expansively. Brody was a unique case.
It said only express. In that case, there were implicit decisions made along the way, and that was the argument the government made, and we rejected it. And here there's an implicit decision made not to decide a case until a certain point.
Well, Your Honor, let me back up. What Brody did confirm, I think, and what the prior 511 decisions, Thomas and Price, confirmed in this court, was that where a court is called upon, a district court or court of appeals is called upon to adjudicate whether the VA has acted properly in claims related to benefits, that is squarely precluded. That's the very thing, that's the sort of the heart of what Section 511 precludes and what the VJRA intended to preclude. In an unreasonable delay case,
Brody,
that's precisely...
Brody, the claim was that there was a cover-up within the Veterans Administration of the material that would have been necessary for the secretary to look at in order to make the right decision.
And that goes to
implicit decisions before the express decision.
But I think, again, that's reading Brody very broadly. I think the problem there was that there was no claim that was ever brought there because there had been the prior cover-up. So there was no action by the VA relating to benefits at that point. That's what Brody was saying, is that you didn't have a claim there. You didn't have any sort of mismanagement of a claim. In an unreasonable delay case, especially one where you're trying to assert a systematic unreasonable delay, you would be called upon to say that the VA has acted unreasonably. They've acted improperly across the board. They're, going too slowly in adjudicating claims. It's not just that they are acting too slowly in terms of, the things that lead up to claims. It's that they're acting too slowly when they actually issue claims as well. That's the very heart of what Section 511 is intended to preclude. And Congress says this is not, about precluding judicial review altogether. As the Court has noted, this is about channeling these claims to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and to the Federal Circuit ultimately. That's what Congress said when it granted limited review of these claims. It said this is the system it needs to go through, and that's why our Section 704 argument is in there. And as Your Honor recognized, the Beeman case in the Sixth Circuit holds that Section 704, says that this is an adequate alternative remedy in the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. And so all these arguments sort of, they come together in the sense that Congress specified the way the scheme should work, specified the way benefits claims should be reviewed, gave a system that can address all sorts of claims, including claims of unreasonable delay. And I want to pause there because I don't think it's true that you have to wait for a decision in order to bring a claim of unreasonable delay. I mean, it's just like in district court, if someone or any agency proceeding, if an agency's sitting on something,
well,
you petition for a writ.
Counsel says the Court of Veterans Claims specifically said it could not rule on an unreasonable delay issue prior to a decision being
made. That's not correct. I don't know what counsel is referring to there, but as far as I understand, the claims are in fact made. When an individual case sits for too long, an individual claimant can bring a claim for unreasonable delay, just like you could in any agency case.
Well, that's what I thought too. Yeah.
Right, and you look at the factors that are specific to the case. This is a very important point because in assessing unreasonable delay, as the Court said in Mashpee, in any unreasonable delay case, you have to look at all the factors that go in. Some cases are more complicated than others. Your Honor asked, if this Court sat on this case for 3 years, you might start to think unreasonable delay, but you would have to look at the complexity of the case. You have to look at the specific factors here.
And well, now, wait a minute. You're not conceding.
I'm not conceding. No, certainly.
So that would be a constitutional violation because we're not covered under APA.
Well, I understand that. So it's an inapt analogy, but I think the point is that I'm trying to make with the inapt analogy is that in any unreasonable delay case, you look at the specific factors that lead to the delay in this case. And some of these claims are, in fact, very complicated. And 160 days might be pretty darn good, actually, in adjudicating a claim. Now, there are additional delays further along in the process, in the appeals process. And those are also, the VA is working on those as well. It is important to note, and the court in the Veterans for Common Sense case that held the trial out in San Francisco noted that affects a very small percentage of the total claims because only about 11% or so actually appeal because largely benefits are granted at that initial level. And so when you start talking about, is there unreasonable delay in the appellate process versus the trial process, you get into a diversion of resources problem. Should you be trying to get it right the first time?
Is there any case that you can point to where the Veterans Court has specifically ruled that it has jurisdiction or has power to remedy an unreasonable delay case?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor, but if that's important to the court, we can certainly find that and submit it supplementally. I don't think that those things are normally brought because, again...
Well, is there any case holding they can't do it?
No, not to my knowledge. Again, And the statute specifically says...
The statute seems to specifically give them that authority.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do they have access to the All Writs Act?
I believe so. I mean, plaintiffs make a point of saying, well, it's only in an extraordinary case that you would compel agency action reasonably. Well, that's true of district courts as well. I mean, this is not something that you normally do where you sort of have to, you know, issue a writ and speed up the process. There are quality concerns.
38 U.S.C. 7261A2.
That's correct.
Explicitly gives the CAVC authority to compel VA actions unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed.
That's correct.
That is correct. So I don't see why they don't have authority then.
I agree. They do have authority, and the Federal Circuit would necessarily have authority as sitting as the court reviewing that court. So given that authority, the plaintiffs are making is, well, that's not good enough because what we want to do is a broader claim, a fix the system claim. And our point is when you start talking about fix the system claims, you've gone way beyond the rubric of unreasonable delay as set forth in Southern Utah and other cases, you know, giving the limitations of 706.1. You can't have a fix the system sort of claim, and you know that you really can't have a fix the system sort of claim because in this situation you have Congress precluding judicial review.
You have a more exquisite, even elegant argument pointing that out. If the individuals whose position is necessary to confer standing have an adequate remedy by bringing a unreasonable delay case before the Veterans Court, then they are uninterested individually in a systemic relief because they have specific relief. If they are uninterested in systemic relief, then there is no standing for the systemic relief. That's a blending together of your argument, but I don't think you quite made it, but it's the jurisdictional point, so we can. That if the individuals have an adequate remedy, the individuals that we must look to determine inter alia whether the organization has standing, have an adequate remedy, and therefore do not have a cause of action under APA, and then you also make the point that the constitutional claim is simply a thinly disguised APA claim, then those individuals do not have standing to assert an injury over a systemic claim because that's an injury to other people, not to them.
I think that's right, Your Honor, and I think that's what both the district court and we were perhaps both inelegantly trying to get to is this the combination of those factors that, yes, precludes this sort of broad systematic claim.
Well, I'll have to wait and see what counsel says.
Let me ask about that. In any organizational standing case, at least one of the members could have brought the case on his own.
Well, but I think that's the point, is that the individual members couldn't bring this sort of claim. The individuals have an adequate forum for their injuries, their injury, i.e., they're sitting on the claim for too long.
Okay,
they have a forum.
They could have brought their own claim.
And I think that's what Judge Silverman is suggesting.
In other words, if the three of us are veterans, and we represent the class here or the group, I like to point to myself as
you
the
are
one who gets
veteran.
The relief. If I could get relief, then I'm indifferent to whether Judge Ginsburg and Judge Kavanaugh can get relief.
Well, without being so callous.
As a legal matter, Your Honor.
A legal interest.
Exactly.
I think it's a legal
different
interest.
Law. I care desperately about their relief, exactly, yes, but I don't have any injury.
I understand, Your Honor.
I stand corrected.
Unless there are any further questions, we'll rest on the papers. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Katnick, could you address the point you just heard discussed?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. First of all, and I apologize if I misspoke, I tried to say that the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims has no writ authority for systemic violations. Now, the colloquy that's just occurred says, well, then that leads to there's an adequate remedy at law for individual claimants, therefore they don't have standing, therefore the organization doesn't have standing. And I, with respect to the APA argument or claim, I understand that logic. I would respectfully submit that an organization, the organization does not have any adequate remedy at law, number one. Number two, it doesn't address the due process clause. I mean, there is no predicate.
He makes an argument, which is a pretty strong argument, that the due process clause is simply a pleading mechanism that is fundamentally an APA unlawful delay.
Well, Your Honor,
and if you're right about that, every single APA unlawful delay case could be brought as a due process case.
Well, no, if I may, Your Honor, that's
not. Involves, I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't, any case wouldn't be a due process case.
Well, Your Honor, they may start out at the same place, but hypothetically, if you have claimants who are saying, I can't get there, it takes too long, it takes me forever, the Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims has said they won't fix systemic violations, so they've got to hope someday somebody has enough perseverance to get there, to get a writ. That's not, number one, I'd submit that's not an adequate remedy law with respect. Number two, there may come a time when the due process clauses, whatever else may be the limits of the APA ability to get this, due process says this is too much. So I would say there may come a point in time where even though you might not have an APA claim that hypothetically, and not conceding this point, might fail because there is an adequate remedy at law, that does not mean that when applied to the facts of this case, which is a systemic problem, that would be a bar to a due process claim.
I didn't look into this, but do you know whether are you familiar with any due process claims that are based on delay?
Yes,
usually they're based on not getting enough process, which would cause more delay.
I apologize for not being able to recite them off the top of my head, but I'm quite certain that some of the Social Security cases were due process claims as well as APA claims, and I believe there are others, but I forgive me if I cannot recite them off the top of my head.
Okay. Further questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Katnick. Mr. Scarborough, thank you. The case is submitted.